And back here on the Mighty 690 KGGF here on this Wednesday morning. And real quick before we get back, we have had a caller waiting on the line for us, so we'll get to him. Thanks for being patient, caller. Do you have a question for Jacob or James this morning? Well, and we may have lost you there over the news break there. Give us a call at 620-251-6909. Again, we apologize for the break there, but the phone lines are back open for James and Jacob to answer your questions. And as we led into the 8 o'clock hour, we were on a topic right now, kind of differentiating the two between THC and CBD. And real quick, before we get there, James, again, we got that caller back on the line here, so we'll get to him. Good morning, caller. Do you have a question for James or Jacob?
Yes, I do. I wonder when I can cut back my mum's
chrysanthemums?
Yes.
Okay. Are they done blooming?
Not quite.
All right.
I just wondered what the freeze would do to them and when I could trim them down.
Yeah, wait and see what happens with the freeze. They may continue, and of course they're down hugging the ground, and they may be in a little bit more protected location up close to the foundation. So they may go ahead and survive, and you can enjoy the flowers a little bit longer. You don't have to get in a hurry to cut them down. It's not necessary, but once they're good, froze hard, then you can cut it back a little bit. I'd like to leave a little bit of that top on just to protect the base of the plant, protect the crown of the plant, so it overwinters a little bit better. But
they're getting so straggly each year. They're old plants.
Oh, okay.
Bushy.
You need to dig them and divide them and start with new plants in a new location start them that way. And they'll recover. But leaving them in the same spot year after year after year, they'll do that. They'll play out.
So it won't hurt to cut them back right away. I mean, after the freeze.
It probably is not going to hurt them. If tops are frozen, the top is no longer of any value to the plant. It's not getting any plant nutrients or anything like that. Photosynthates. To put that with sugars, that the plant's not producing any energy for the plant. The above ground portion, it's essentially dead. And but the only thing I was suggesting, if you leave that top on, it kind of holds a little bit of leaves and debris and stuff around the crown of the plant, protects that crown from cold temperatures over the winter, which may be a little bit beneficial, but it should survive otherwise. If you cut it off, it'll be fine.
So, okay, thank you.
Yep.
All right, thanks for the call this morning. And again, 251-6909 is that number to dial. And again, we'll get right back into it. Our neighbors to the east just passing a law with medicinal marijuana, but this is not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about industrial hemp, as James Cooper again here with us this morning with the K-State Extension District, breaking down the differences between industrial hemp and, you know, marijuana medicinally or recreational use, whichever. There is a difference between the two.
Yeah, and so really, industrial hemp has three uses, or marijuana has three uses, or there's three different things that we take out of it. One is the hemp part, which is actually the fibrous part of the plant that we use to make things like rope and various other things. It's a very resistant and strong rope, and there's a lot of applications that we can use for it, and have done so in the past. The THC, which is the part that, you know, that gets people high, and also the CBD. Both of those, CBD and THC, are from the female bud part of the plant. And the CBD, it's not intoxicating in any way, but it does have some medical uses to it. The rules and regulations, and so before I talked about the Industrial Hemp Research Program, which is what they had passed at the state level to kind of get an idea to begin the process of what it is. And so we can't grow hemp yet. That's something far away. We're not there yet, or even close, honestly. So right now, next year, they should pass the rules and regulations on the Industrial Hemp Research Program. Research is kind of a key word here. And so they're still making those rules. It's unofficial right now. They're not going to have them until next year. Once the rules are set, growing hemp is still going to be very difficult. One thing is that, first of all, if you're wanting to participate in this research program, you have to have a license. You have to demonstrate that this is actually just for research, and it has to have an approved advisory board. And so this isn't for the average everyday farmer who wants to grow some hemp and see if there's a market for it. This is more for a research situation, and it's got to involve those research people. And so really, some of the complications to this is that the seed from the hemp has to come from a certified seed. Of course, there is no certified seed in this state for hemp, and so we'll have to import it from another state. And there is some problem with exporting hemp across state lines, because, I mean, you're transporting marijuana across state lines.
You are, yeah.
And so there's some issues with that. Basically, you have to go and get it yourself in a way. I don't think they can put that in the mail. Maybe I'm not positive on that part. And there's another difficult caveat to this, is that if you get certified hemp seed that has been proven, they grow it just for industrial hemp, not for marijuana. The THC is very low. That's a species, or it's a variety type that grows very low THC levels. However, if you grew that and for some reason it's above that 0.4 THC, you have grown something illegal. You have done an illegal act. And so even if it wasn't supposed to be, there's a gray area, as in
a large gray area.
Yeah, you just grew an illegal crop. You have to get rid of it, obviously. And so, but you still did something illegal. So you have to, besides just part of the research program, you have to have a very good connection with your local law enforcement, so that way they know exactly what you're doing and what is going on and who you are. And so it's not something you should do in your backfield just for the fun of it. Everything needs to be crystal clear. Exactly what's going on.
You're going to have to jump through a few hoops. Got to make sure the dots above the I's are perfect, the T's are crossed. I mean, it comes down to it. And again, in the preliminary stages, this is expected, you know, because, yeah, again, you're right. We are in the research stages. You need to get the research behind it, the backing behind it, and to make sure that it is a good decision to, you know, 5-10 years down the line, if it turns into a market here in Kansas, then we have all the research behind it. And I think that's a good first step.
Yes, yeah. And, I mean, it's going to be expensive at first, too, because hardly anybody's doing this. And so the licensing is going to be over $1,000 per year, and there's going to be even more licensing on top of that. A lot of regulations with this. It's really not for everybody. It probably has to be somewhat connected with the university to have that research part of it. And there are some people at K-State University that are actually, I think, are on that advisory board for the program. So...
Gotcha. Yeah. Again, preliminary stages always brings. It's tough to kind of go around, dip your toes in, and again, you deal with the psychoactive part of the plant, the THC, and that's where it kind of surprises me that fine line you can go from creating research, creating something backing for science, to actually breaking the law within a few percentages of the THC level. So it's good to know that the state is keeping an eye on those, because, again, you don't need illicit growth or sales of marijuana within the state, no doubt about. But, again, I think there is some benefits to hemp and the medicinal side of marijuana. That's another side of conversation for a different day. But, again, the potential is there for industrial hemp use.
Yeah, yeah.
Got a question, James, on product that is produced from industrial hemp, the textile product. Is there any potential for the THC to be in that product, or is that something that's completely removed in the processing part?
I am not exactly sure how much that THC survives the industrial process. However, keep in mind, it would be such a very low percentage. I mean, it would take a concentration of bushel baskets to get enough for, 65 times less THC than a normal marijuana. And so there really is no way that you can get a whole lot of THC from industrial hemp. Yeah, but I don't know if that chemical survives the process.
Yeah, that's a good question with that as well, because, again, you know, you grow that fine line of, hey, if there happens to be a high percentage of the THC in this, how much does that resonate into the end of the fibrous material or whatever it is that it, that comes away from it? So that's a good question with that as well. And, again, any questions out there, you can give us a call at 620-251-6909 as Jacob Weber and James Cooper in here this morning. On a pretty good discussion. Again, it's something that, you know, for the casual listener, whichever, they don't necessarily know the difference between the two. And again, in terms of market, in terms of growth, 10, 15 years down the line, it may be something that, you know, the market-wise, certainly flourishing with. You said it takes some money to get it started, but it might be something to make some money later on as well.
Yeah.
And with that, I think we do have a caller on the line, so we'll go check the phones. Good morning, caller. Do you have a question for James or Jacob?
Yeah, I was wondering what the best way to get rid of sage grass or poverty grass out of your pasture.
That'd be a James question.
And so, brome sage or poverty grass, it's got a bunch of different names. But really, it's that grass is a symptom of something that's going on in your field. And usually that symptom, it's a symptom of low phosphorus and low fertility within the field. And so there's no good way of getting rid of it. There's no aerial spray that you can spray on brome sedge to get rid of it. You can spot spray it during certain times during the year with Roundup just over that one small area. But otherwise, just getting your soil fertility up, then slowly managing that poverty grass out of the area. And usually it takes 3 or 4 years of good management to really get rid of it. And there'll always be a little bit of it around, but...
Yeah. Well, there's no value to it at all, is there? I mean, as far as...
Very little. And So in the spring, when it's really nice and green, all the other bromes are doing good, so is it. Cows will eat it. But it gets stimmy real fast, and then they just stop, so...
Yeah. So it would probably be a good idea to do a soil sample then, too, wouldn't it?
That would be a very good idea to get some soil samples done. And, you know, call your local extension office. We'll get you set up with a soil probe and give you a kind of a plan of action how to take those soil samples. So,
okay, I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call this morning. And with that as well, you know, last week we kind of hit on it. Soil testing would be a good time this week, last week as well, kind of getting into that. And you guys do provide, as you mentioned, James, some equipment for fall soil testing.
Yeah, and so... really the only good way is, this is my opinion, the only good way to take a soil test is with a soil probe. It is very hard to take one accurately without it, and it takes a lot more time. And so with a soil probe, you can take a soil test really fast and you can cover a lot more ground. And so, that's
provided the ground isn't hard.
Yeah, that's true.
Is
too.
It frozen over?
If it's
yeah.
frozen, it's, yeah.
Frozen or dry. Yeah. We had one soil probe that was murdered, put that way.
Yeah.
With a hammer.
Saying it lightly.
With a hammer. They're trying to get it in the ground. They smash that thing to pieces.
And Jacob, you were mentioning as well last week, when someone is taking a soil test, to take it from multiple locations around
right.
the property.
Yeah, but just one spot is not good, because it only tells us what is one spot. But when you get multiple locations, at least 15 or 20, depending on the size of the field, it may have to be a considerable number more than that. But you blend them together, and that gives you an average. And then, of course, in a field situation, you can actually localize different areas of the field that may need to be to sample differently because, for example, erosion, a hillside or something like that, or a low area where the organic matter is higher. There are some differences within a field. So, but in a garden, small garden, 10 to 12 subsamples blended together would be good. And, of course, I was just going to say one more thing about that poverty grass situation. James, is a grazing play an issue in the development of poverty grass or that broom sedge?
It does a little bit because cows are intentionally avoiding that brome sedge later on in the season. And so it gives it a competitive advantage later on.
Yeah. So overgrazing may have a tendency to produce an undesirable effect on the pasture itself.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Again, Jacob Weber and James Cooper in with here as just a couple minutes till we hit the bottom of the hour. As any final notes that you guys have been getting, calls, maybe questions that our listeners may have answered?
If I look back over my notes here, not too much. It's all over the board. Actually, one person wanted to know how to choose a lopping shears. What type? What should I get? Isn't it a lopping shears? You know what a lopping shears is. It's a big shears to cut large branches. Usually a regular size lopping shear going to cut up to half inch diameter branch. Pruning those larger branches a lot easier than using a hand shears, but I have used a hand shears on half inch diameter branches and larger actually, and it really involves a lot of pressure, and it's not so good with for certain shears. But then there are some lopping shears that can handle branches up to an inch in diameter, but they'll have a lever mechanism or a ratchet mechanism that makes it a little bit easier and a little bit stronger.
Makes it a little bit easier. And real quick before we hit the bottom of the hour as well, last caller on the line is, good morning, caller. Do you have a question for James or Jacob?
I guess Jacob. I was just wondering, we put mushroom compost on our garden sometimes, and I just wondered, is that okay, or do you need to put something else with it, like a fertilizer? Or?
With everything that you put on your garden, watch your application rate. Application rates are very important. I'd say for mushroom compost, one, possibly two bushels per 100 square foot initially per year. Then watch your soil pH, because mushroom compost does have lime added, and it has a tendency to raise your soil pH. So soil testing every 3 to 5 years is a good idea. And if you get a situation where your pH is above 7.5, then I'd say maybe you want to back off on using mushroom compost, using something else instead. And as far as mushroom compost goes, it's a little bit dry on nitrogen, so a little bit of nitrogen fertilizer with it will help it decompose a little bit faster. A fall application is good, and I'm talking about not late fall, but early fall, September, October, and soil moisture is very important to help it decompose. If we have dry soil and cool soil, that mushroom compost is just going to sit there, and it's going to wait until in the following spring when things are a little bit wetter and the soil temperature comes up. Of course, in spring, soil temperature is cold, and it's going to be a slow process. So a little bit of extra nitrogen fertilizer. So use something like a turf grass fertilizer and put on about maybe one cup per 100 square foot of area with the mushroom compost. That should be sufficient to take care of the nitrogen fertilizer. And of course, a lawn fertilizer should not have any herbicide in it. Any herbicide product, so be sure that you use something that's fairly clean. Okay.
Where do you get your soil test for that?
Through our extension service, we send that up to the commercial soil testing lab at Kansas State University Agronomy Department, and it's fairly cheap, $10 I think is what it is, $10 to $12 per test, and. That'll be good, usually for gardens. The fertility management recommendation is good for 3 to 5 years.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for the call. And again, that's James Cooper and Jacob Weber checking in with us with the K-State Extension. We will check in with you guys next Wednesday.
Thank you.
All right. This is the Mighty 690 KGGF.